OTB Sports Golf Weekly with Now TV. Watch Sky Sports on the Now TV Sky Sports Pass and watch BT Sport and Premier Sports on the Sports Extra Pass.
All right, you're very welcome along to Golf Weekly. Nathan in the presenter's chair this week. It's a revolving scenario. Everyone's on a little bit of holidays here and there, so we've no Joe this week. But Dave McIntyre has retained his place after rave reviews last week. He's managed to keep his place. How are you keeping, Dave?
It's all that a man can hope for is to avoid being returned to the bench the following week.
Of course, he wasn't the only one to receive rave reviews on last week's show. We had a new addition to Golf Weekly, somebody who really knows what he's talking about, a real expert on the game. Gary Murphy was with us last week, and you guys were loving him, absolutely loving him. He's not here this week, though. Fit for Golf said, most recent episode was my favorite in a long time. Well, screw you, Fit for Golf. He did say Ian and Gary Murphy are welcome additions. So I'm not sure who Ian is. Unfortunately, he's calling you Ian there, Dave. A lot of people enjoy Gary Murphy. Lads, great pod again. Gary Murphy was excellent. His line quality was terrible, though. Please fix for next time. Dave Tyrrell said, Gary Murphy, great addition to the pod this week. Gav Lines, best pod in a long time. More Gary Murphy, please. Peter Lawrie's with us this week.
Shocking, isn't it? Hello, Nathan. How are you?
They just take us for granted.
Absolutely, you know.
It's just fresh. It's new. Peter, look, we'll get Gary and Peter on together someday.
Just leave the two of us on, and yourself and Joe go on holidays, and we'll bring in Dave for the, you know, the odd bit.
I should point out, for the first time in a long time, and this is going to be the way going forward, we are live right now. We're going live to the nation. We're live on all our streaming channels, so you can watch us on offtheball.com/YouTube or catch us on Periscope, or you can leave us some live comments as well if you want on Twitter or YouTube, and we'll try and get to them between now and the end of the show. We'll always be starting around 1:30, 2:00. We will start telling you exactly when that is. What that does mean, Peter, you know, the old libel laws.
I have the lawyer just outside, and he's just going to bang the door if I say something any incriminating to anybody.
If Peter's line just suddenly drops, yeah, we know what's happened. He said something outrageous. As always, Golf Weekly brought to you in association with Now TV. Watch Sky Sports on the Now TV Sky Sports Pass and watch BT Sport and Premier Sports on the Sports Extra Pass. So, you spoke a lot last week, Dave, about the PGA and about Colin Morikawa's win. Peter, we are still, the nation awaits your thoughts, because my most recent memory of you talking about Morikawa was after his last victory, his victory at the Workday, where he beat Justin Thomas in the playoff, and you thought, yeah, this guy's good. He's good. I don't know if he's going to get to full-on greatness. He'll win tournaments. He's probably a top 10 player. Yet now, we're looking at a guy who may well dominate for the next decade.
Yeah, look, we all get it wrong sometimes.
You get it wrong all the time, seems to be the problem. Yeah,
well, look, if you keep on inviting me back, I'm going to get it wrong most of the time. But there you go. Look, he played tremendous golf. To win a major at such a young age is unbelievable. And yeah, look, he's going to be a force to be reckoned with. But you also said that about Jordan Spieth, and poor Jordan now is somewhere down the rankings and struggling badly. So we just can't tell whether.
Can you compare the two? Because it does seem as though their games are quite different. Like, you would often say that Spieth's game ultimately revolved around this outrageous putting streak that was always going to end at some stage, whereas Morikawa is just so solid in every part of his game.
No, I was comparing them to be coming onto the scene and being so successful so early.
Right.
That's what I was comparing them. No, they're two totally different golf games. I would say Morikawa would love to have Spieth's putting stroke, while Spieth would love to have Morikawa's long game.
Peter, last week I asked Joe and Gary whether or not they'd go over or under 5 majors for Morikawa. Both went over.
What?
Yeah.
See, people get carried away. It's ridiculous. You know what I mean? It was like Tiger Woods, you know, how many majors is he going to win? How many majors is he going to go past Jack Nicklaus? And that didn't happen as of yet, as they say. But no, look, it's so difficult to win a golf tournament now. Look at our best player, Rory McIlroy. Hasn't won one in how many years?
Six.
So, you know, I can't see how he's going to get to that major tally so quickly.
It's always a strange and difficult conversation around how many majors players are going to win, because Morikawa is 23. He could still be contending for a major in 20 years when we're long gone with our golf podcast and nobody will ever remember what we've said. But I'm shocked that they would both go at over five. Like, even when we're talking about Rory and what he might ultimately get to, people go, oh, seven or eight, as if winning another three or four is an easy thing. He's probably been the best player of the post-Tiger generation, McIlroy. He still only won four of them.
Yeah. Oh, I know. It's a serious ask for anybody to get to five. It's such a small elite club of those who've won five majors plus. I think a lot of it was based on A, the fact that he's so young. B, there doesn't seem to be a weakness in his game apart from what we thought was a slight vulnerability over short putts when the pressure really increased. And we saw that in Muirfield a few weeks ago, but he obviously bounced back brilliantly from that. And it was because of all the majors that he would potentially win disappeared. It might be the most difficult because it was on what we thought was a bomber's paradise, a long golf course with thick rough. And he overpowered that golf course on the Sunday in particular. And that conceivably winning at Augusta or winning at an Open where conditions are reasonably tough should be easier than what he managed to achieve last weekend. So I think you throw all those factors together, that might encourage some people to get a little carried away and look above five.
A lot of people found that the most refreshing aspect of it, Peter, that this, when you looked at the rest of the leaderboard, by and large was a bomber's paradise. Yet here is this guy who hits fairways and greens who was able to compete. With what Dave's saying there and the fact he was able on that sort of course to go and win the tournament and win it so well and play just outstanding golf in that final day with the round of 64. Is he still at a distinct disadvantage, though, on the vast majority of major courses? While he might have the perfect week like he had that week, by and large, not being one of those longest hitters is going to catch up with him.
I think on major tallies, probably not. But definitely on your regular type golf courses, yes. Major tournaments, you can kind of get it away with it. And we've seen quite a few short hitters win majors. Zach Johnson being one of the major ones. You know, one of the shortest hitters out there. And he won the Masters, did he not?
Yeah, on seven.
Yeah.
Led up to every hole.
Exactly. So
that was a unique Masters weekend, though, in fairness, yeah. Peter. It was horrendous weather. Greens are rock hard. They haven't had weather, in as far as I can remember, before or since that I've been watching the Masters. So, yeah, I take it. Zach Johnson, obviously, incredibly short off the tee and did win, but that's absolutely an outlier. I don't think Morikawa was in a similar bracket. He's about 35 yards longer off the tee for a start.
Yeah, I was just trying to make the point, though, that, you know, it is possible for a short hitter to win majors. While not too many short hitters win it on bomber's paradises on regular tour events. You know, they struggle on those type of golf courses because the likes of Dustin Johnson, Rory, Bryson DeChambeau now have such an advantage over them when they're hitting in wedges to greens where they're going in with five and six irons.
So when we had that situation heading down towards the back nine and there's six, seven players tied for the lead, and it feels like anybody, it could be anybody's, and like it's such a stacked leaderboard in terms of quality. Morikawa was the most steady one, but we're still surprised that he was the one who came through over that back nine.
Very much so. Very much so. The shot that he hit into 16, wasn't it? The eagle that he made there, that was just sublime. Especially when he stated that he would lay up on that hole every day because it was too tight. And it's unusual for such a young guy to have a realization of how they're going in the tournament and how one shot can win him the golf tournament. And if this comes off, you know, I'm going to pull away from the field. Normally you would get, I'm going to stick to my guns and, you know, lay it up and try and make birdie that way. But that was the turning point of the golf tournament. So
you'd wonder what a shot like that does to his career. Sorry, you'd wonder what, because there's obviously the execution of the shot, the technical execution of the shot and nailing the swing, and so many of the other players couldn't do that. But actually, The balls to do that at that stage of the tournament, knowing what was at stake, and the confidence as you go through majors over the next few weeks, but over the coming years of, you know, when it really mattered, I was able to deliver.
I was able to pull it out of the bag, yeah. And I look back and I still think of it to this day. In my own Spanish Open, would be my own, you know, sort of day in the sun. I hit a four iron on the 15th hole at an opportunity to go for the green, par five. I didn't fancy the shot. My caddy talked me into it. And it was the right shot. It was a 4-iron over water. I wanted to lay up because the pin was on the front. And he says, we haven't come here to lay up. We've come here to win the golf tournament. And that making birdie there, birdie 17, you know, got into a playoff and won the golf tournament. So they're the kind of shots that stay with you. And then every time you have a similar situation, you think, right, I can go for this now. You know, I have it. And probably he will go for it more often than not now going forward, and which will probably win him more tournaments than it will lose him tournaments.
Talk us through that conversation then, Spanish Open, and how in-depth and how long a conversation when there's so much at stake for your career and for the caddy as well. Like, it can't have been as simple as we're not here to lay up, we're here to win the tournament.
It was, because to be honest with you, I had such a good caddy on the bag, Dermot Byrne. And it was right then, like I always say, you know, your caddy is like, it's like being a jockey on a horse, and they're steering the horse in the right direction. And when they get a chance, they have to put the right club in the player's hand and with total conviction. Like if I had turned around and hit that 4-iron in the water, I would have blamed him, but he was willing to go hit the 4-iron, you idiot, and get it on the green, you know? And to be honest, which I trusted him, so I went for it.
And was there a tone in the way he said it that you knew
he meant it? I was getting no other club.
Right.
No other club. He would have ran away from me if I had asked him for 8 or 9 iron to lay up.
You obviously weren't in your heart of hearts wanting to lay up. Otherwise, you would have done. You just needed a little bit of coaxing, I suspect.
Correct.
And he said the right thing at the right time. You really did want to hit the 4-iron. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been able to commit to it in the way that you did.
No, probably not. No, you're probably right there, Dave. But there was a niggling feeling walking up to say, right, my short game was so good from my wedge play was so good. I thought I could make birdie, you know, by laying it up as well. But it was a chance to make eagle probably and you know, move yourself away a bit like Morikawa making eagle on 16. He just leapfrogged everybody.
Did you need that? Because this is, again, you're going for a European Tour win. Would you have been happy to make the decision yourself, or did you need the caddy? Did you need somebody else to make the decision for you?
Looking back, I probably needed somebody else to make the decision for me, to be downright ruthless and go, that's the club, hit it, and that's it, you know.
Mm.
And it was perfect words, you know. We didn't come here to lay up.
Did that put extra pressure on you hitting the actual shot?
No. I hit it and that was it. I was quite good with a 4-iron in those days, so it wasn't too bad.
those days.
Yeah. What was the yardage? Where were you hitting your 4-iron in those days? How far?
I had 200 and something over the water, but it was warm. It was in Seville, so the ball was flying miles. So for me, you know, I think it was about 210. 4-iron used to go about 195. I wasn't a long hitter, Dave, unfortunately. These guys can hit 8-iron.
A wedge for Dustin Johnson, depending
exactly.
on the humidity. Before we leave the PGA, and even there's still some fallout from it, and Brooks Koepka was talking to Damon Lynch about some of his comments, and we get on to Koepka, maybe leave him out of it. Of the players that were in contention then, who are the ones that left the regrets? Who are the ones that you were disappointed with on the Sunday?
That's...
DJ?
It's hard to tell. DJ is he's one of these players. Does he ever, tell me a tournament that he hasn't somewhat messed up? Apart from the one that he robbed from Shane Lowry, and that one, every time he seems to get it into a position, he finds a way to back his way out of it. Especially majors, normal tournaments, he seems to be able to go and blitz the field and blitz a Sunday. But in a major, he seems to be able to fall backwards.
Koepka was obviously the big disappointment on the Sunday, because it was all set up, you felt, on Saturday night. He wins this tournament. He's the one we're talking about, possibly as the best of the post-Tiger generation. Gets to 5 majors. And and nothing happens from at all playing alongside Paul. Actually, just Paul Casey. I don't know if you spoke much about Paul Casey. What did you make of Casey's post-round interview?
Yeah, asking me.
Either
I didn't see it.
I don't know. Like, I think Paul Casey's inherently a nice guy, but I have always felt that he lacked something when it came to what it took to win a major championship. And he probably should have been devastated that he lost that championship, because he's in his 40s now. The chances are, I'd say he can probably count on one hand the opportunities he may get in the next 5 years before his game starts to desert him and he may start looking towards the seniors tour, because that's going to come down the track very quickly. I know that I've seen interviews with him in the past, in maybe 10 years, where he's very pleased that he's playing good golf, because we forget this is a guy whose career was pretty much done and he had fallen way down the rankings and he was wandering around in the wilderness and had injuries. It never looked like he'd get back. So you can appreciate that he's probably happy to be contending, but I would have thought he would be a little more disappointed not to have got the job done. Now, it may be a bit easier, Nathan, in that he knew that he didn't lose the tournament. Mm-hmm. Morikawa went out and took it from him. Of all the guys that played to their best on the Sunday and really tried to chase down the leader, it was Casey. So that might have been in his thinking as well. He didn't miss a putt or hit a poor shot in the last three holes. It was taken off him by spectacular golf.
Yeah, I guess, look, golf, a game of honour, a game of class, and he showed all of that, but it was almost too accepting. And you think back to 2010 and the Open at St. Andrews when he played with Louis Westhuizen, and he almost made it a stroll in the park for Westhuizen, and he was so chilled out. There was no, you know, this is the final round of an Open Championship, I'm not going to talk to you for the 18 holes. And again, even 10 years on, as you say, when it probably is one of his final chances, come on, Jesus, you need to be a bit of a bastard sometimes.
Well, yeah,
but maybe it's not just him.
Yeah, it's hard to be a bastard to when, like, the guy that's won is this up-and-coming kid who is probably going to be around for a long time, and sometimes you just have to accept that the guy played better golf than you on the day, despite how well Casey played. The other aspect of 2010, I mean, he walked on the first tee at St. Andrews knowing there was absolutely no chance he was going to win that tournament. I mean, was he seven back from Westhuizen?
Was he not only four back going into the final round and ended up finishing about eight back?
I thought it was more than that. Now, he didn't play that well, but I don't think the Paul Casey of 2010 really thought that he was going to win that day.
But, listen, I just want everybody to be Brooks Koepka. I just want everybody to be calling out everybody all day long. So obviously Brooks then made the comments on the Saturday night, Peter, and didn't back them up. Eamon Lynch managed to catch up with him over the last week or so before he pulled out of the Northern Trust this week with his knee problem, and I presume he's just skipping these tournaments. They're saying end of the season, but you presume he'll be back for the US Open and for the Masters. So he was asked about the comments, and particularly the one of Dustin's one, and the rest of them, yeah. He said, I honestly was struggling coming down the end of the third round. I was well back and I saw DJ was at -9, a birdie to get to -7. I was focused on Dustin. I had no idea who was at 8. Are with me at 7. To be honest, when I'm looking at a leaderboard, I'm never looking at who's behind me or tied with me. I'll only look ahead. I view myself as going forward no matter what. So I regret that part of it. That's what I was trying to say, that I didn't know who was on the leaderboard at that point because I hadn't looked. I genuinely didn't know the guys at 8 and 7. That part I regret, and I wish I had used different words because I didn't pay enough attention to who was under Dustin because he was my main focus. When someone asks if I can win, I'm always going to say yes. That's the competitor in me. I'm not there to finish second. I think that's where some of the cocky stuff comes from, because I always think I can win and I truly believe it. Is that fair enough, Peter?
He reminds me of, did you see that interview by Ronnie O'Sullivan the other day in the snooker?
Kids are all useless.
Telling them they're all useless. They should be able to beat me. And if they can't beat me, they're completely useless and I don't care about them. He seems to have that, as I've said before, this kind of persona that he is the best and nobody can beat me. And he walks around like that as well. And by the way, Dave, I purposely coughed there a few minutes ago when you were talking about Paul Casey. That wasn't involuntary.
That was good. It was too good.
Oh, was it? Okay.
So what's your issue with Paul Casey? Again, live, Peter.
See, there's the knock on the door, so I can't really say too much.
Oh, this is around the bit where I said he's inherently a nice guy.
Exactly, yeah. See, it's terrible to have to explain your own jokes, you know?
Why is he not a nice guy?
No, don't ask him.
The
that.
Lawyer is banging on the door. Hey. I hear him knocking on the door to come in.
This isn't my podcast, Nathan. It'll
be your last time on it, Dave, the way things are going. Is there a non-libelous version? Did you just not get on with him? Okay, if there's no non-libelous. Okay, if there's no non-libelous, you didn't get on with him.
The thing that I could... Yeah, no.
Are you talking in the present, Peter? Because I know Paul Casey didn't make many friends in his early years on the PGA Tour and European Tour, and I know he fell out with a couple of Ryder Cup captains, and he obviously had those comments about the American people in the galleries, which certainly didn't endear him to the PGA Tour audience either. So, yeah, a few years. I think in the last 5 or 6 years, after he's rediscovered his game, and as I say, come back from the dead as a professional golfer, that I think he's mellowed a bit and seems a little more of a chirpy chappy than he once was.
See, I'm one of these people who see things a little bit differently. And have a look at every player that this has happened to and tell me then whether they're nice or not nice people. You're a superstar, okay? And everybody thinks that you're hard to get to, et cetera, et cetera. And then your game disappears, okay? And then on your working your way back up, you start being nice to people. Because you've been up here and now you're way down here, you actually have to be nice to people because there's no way other way of climbing out of the rubbish that you're in. And that's the way I see a lot of golfers who have reached this upper echelon and then, you know, gone way back down. They're actually inherent not the nicest people in the world.
Can people not change?
That's the lawyer
them?
You can hear in the background going, "Stop him now!"
Yeah, can people change?
That's just not human nature. This,
yeah, no, humbling experience. Tough,
No. Anyway,
you're the most unforgiving man there has ever been.
Let's move on.
Was quite honest in the interview with Eamon Lynch. Yeah. Like, he put his hands up and said, "I talked the talk, I didn't walk the walk, so I'm going to have to face down everybody and take the abuse I'm going to get." Was he wrong to say it in the first place?
Of course he was. No? I don't think so.
Some of the comments around it with Eamon Lynch were interesting just because obviously he had it seemed to pop at Dustin Johnson. Everyone thought that DJ and Brooks were friendly. And he sort of made the point, look, we shared a coach for a couple of years, a strength and conditioning coach, and we spent a lot of time around each other. But, you know, were we best friends? I wouldn't go that far. You know, and then he said, I think he made too much of, you know, the whole Justin and Jordan thing. You know, are they really that friendly? Or do you just want it to be this nice little narrative that you can all go along with? So, yeah, he probably phrased it wrong and he comes across as cocky, but if he feels it gives him an advantage, is that not all that matters for him?
Yeah, maybe so. I don't know. I suppose I look at golfers more like the type of your Nicholas. And, you know, there's no need to talk down anybody. Or there's no need to, like, just go out there and try and beat them. If they beat you, then shake their hand and go, well done. Like, how many times did we see Nicholas shake people's hands, like Tom Watson, who beat him in Pebble Beach, or whoever else, and say, look, you know, you played better than me. Well done. Mm. You know, I played my heart out, and that's all I could do. There was no talking it up beforehand or talking it down, you know what I mean? But look, the person that I want to talk about the most today, right, is last week's winner. I have never been so happy. Sorry, I'll rephrase that. I haven't been as happy in a long time watching Jim Hermans win last week.
I thought one for the little guy.
I thought the way he played coming down the stretch was world class.
And right.
My take on this, and I'd love to hear everybody else's take, is how can a guy miss so many cuts and be outside the 200th in the FedEx and produce golf like that coming down the stretch? Like, he didn't miss a shot. So my thing is, his swing is not spectacular. His, you know, his persona is very much the underdog. So how does it happen that a guy can produce this and the likes of
Tony Finau.
Tony Finau, Rory.
Well, that's three wins now for Jim Herman.
Yeah.
He knows how to win. He's a killer. He's like
he's the American Michael Hoey.
when he gets into position, he wins because he knows how to get it done, but he's just not consistent enough to rack up the top 10s required to be in the top 25, 30 on the FedEx Cup rankings season in, season out.
Right, but how does he do it? What switch is on? This is what I'd love to get. Of all people, I'd love to get an opinion on this is Harrington, right? Is what turns on Jim Herman's mind, body, whatever else, to produce golf like this coming down the stretch? Let's go to the amateur golfers who are listening, right? And even we were having a chat there beforehand, Dave, yourself, what turns your own mind to make you win a captain's prize or to shoot the lowest gross, and then all of a sudden the next day it's gone, and you could
can you compare the two
year for it to come back again?
Can you compare the two, the amateur and the professional? Because the amateur, you can have a certain element of everything just clicks on the day. But the professional, he's obviously at an incredibly high, consistent standard anyways.
But he's not, though.
Well, he's on the PGA Tour. He's in and around the PGA Tour. So
yeah, but he's not. Okay, he's won three times. But yes, and given him an opportunity to win, he's won. But you've just told me about Michael Hoey there. Right. Let's talk.
But that's why I wonder when you talk about Harrington. So Harrington, listen, if he comes on and he was to talk about Jim Herman's mindset, I'm sure it would be fascinating and he'd have all sorts of theories.
Yeah.
But actually, Harrington contended at his peak all the time. You know, there was a brilliant consistency to him. Whereas Michael Hoey's record is, I think, a decent comparison because there was certainly a period where every single one of Michael Hoey's top tens on tour was a victory. Yeah. So there were no runner-up finishes, no backdoor into an eighth place finish. Everything was a win, and the rest of it was just so-so. So, like, you know, Michael Hoey,
I do.
What was his mindset that suddenly, when it came to being in contention, he could get the job done, but week in, week out, didn't look like a top quality player.
Yeah, and Brooks Koepka seems to be the same. When a major comes on, he seems to be able to go bang, different class. You know, we were talking about him having a mini slump there a couple of weeks ago, and then all of a sudden in the PGA, he produces golf that hasn't been there for quite some time. So I'd love to tease that out and figure out where does it come from, because it has to be, and we go back to, and I bring it back to Rory McIlroy, it has to be mental, can only be mental. It can't be something that just clicks in your swing.
So is Jim Herman mentally strong or mentally weak? Mentally strong that when he gets in contention that he can go and win? Or is there something mentally weak in his game that he can't do it all the time?
It has to be both. And this is the crazy thing. Like, to hit the shots that he did, and I watched quite a bit of it, to hit the shots that he did into 15, 16, 17 and 18, four shots in a row, 18 being the toughest hole on the golf course, and never looked like winning the tournament until it was all over, pretty much.
Dave, we're looking to you for answers.
Somebody
who just
is.
Turns it on out of nowhere.
Well, as you know, Nathan, playing with me, a mental strength is not one of my strengths.
I go through all that in the space of one hole.
but I'm not sure. I think Peter's probably right. It is both. He doesn't have the mental durability to be able to grind and put himself into contention for a tidy finish at the weekend when it's not going that well for him. And that's why he misses so many cuts. It's why he's had to come from nowhere to make it into the FedEx Cup playoffs. But there's something within him that can stand the pressure when it's at its greatest. And when he knows everybody is looking on him, when he knows all the cameras are on him, when he's in contention, when you are in and around the cut line on a Friday afternoon, there's nobody watching you. You're just going about your business, and particularly nowadays when there's no fans anyway. And maybe he doesn't respond to that. Maybe the stakes have to be higher for him to be able to get the best out of himself. In that regard, he's mentally weak. In his ability to close it out when he's in contention, he's obviously incredibly incredibly strong in that aspect of his game. It's a real conundrum, but he seems to be able to come out the right side of it occasionally. And if he keeps doing this every so often, his exemptions will keep him on the PGA Tour.
But does this happen in any other sport, do you think?
Well, there's you always hear about big game players in football. Even Nathan, you were doing the Johnny Giles all-time best 11s there during lockdown when you guys were looking for content. And twice, I think, on two of his teams, his England 11 and his West Ham 11, he had Bobby Moore. And he never talked about Bobby Moore as being a consistently brilliant centre-half, but that he played well in the really big games. And maybe that's something similar to where these golfers are, that when the really big moments, they play well. The average mundane moments, they struggle to motivate themselves.
Yeah, he'd be worth, when all this quietens down over the next while, and he has a bit of time trying to get him on the show and actually ask him himself as to, like, maybe the run-of-the-mill, week in, week out, he just doesn't get up for it. He just doesn't know when he's going to be in the mood. So, yeah, we'll try and do that over the next little while.
You'll have to do it before he comes a 4 or 5-time PGA Tour winner. You can just about get these guys on off on a Golf Weekly when they're 3-time.
Hey, we had Tom Watson on. Screw you.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great 11 and a half minutes of Tom Watson.
Wow. Well, that wasn't our fault. That was Joe Malloy's internet. That was the problem there. But let's not go back over Tom Watson ground again. Rory's in the news. I think Gary Murphy, again, was very good last week and quite succinct in his analysis of Rory, that he's just not that good a wedge player, and that is holding him back massively. We spent a lot of time on the deep psychological discussions about where he is, and I know McIlroy sort of jokingly, but then the quote was taken out of context of maybe I'm just not as good as I was. He wasn't a factor at all that weekend, unfortunately. And unfortunately as well, that wasn't much of a surprise to anybody.
No, I think you're right there. What could you say about Rory and Murph? Look, I've said it in the past about Rory, and I firmly believe it. If he went down the Dustin Johnson route of wedge play, he'd probably win more golf tournaments. And we're speaking to a guy who is working on his wedge play, but is just probably not finding the success of it. Like, he does hit one or two in close, but there at the Memorial, wasn't it? He missed so many greens with wedges in his hands. I remember Fionn putting out some stats there of how many greens he missed with, from 120 yards, which is shocking for a tour player.
Gary or Peter, what about Gary's assertion last week that maybe he needs to put himself in a position where he's hitting fewer wedges, so that he needs to find himself with a number that he's comfortable with, whether that means he's hitting 8 irons or 9 irons into these greens and needing to hit a 3-wood or a sawn-off driver a bit more often, instead of always going full belt, full-on driver, full-on wedge, because he's trying to hit it 150, 160 yards, whatever it might be. Gary was saying that if you are not that good a wedge player, and this is not a recent phenomenon, and it's certainly not a recent discussion, we've been talking about Rory's wedges for 5 or 6 years now, that maybe he just needs to dial it back and avoid hitting that many wedges, because he's one of the longest hitters in the history of the game. His driver and pitching wedge are going to be the two clubs he utilizes most often, or his gap wedges. So maybe he needs to put himself in a position where he hits them a little more seldom.
But he's taking out one of his strongest skills is the driver, if that's the case.
Like, but his strongest skill is exposing his biggest weakness.
Yeah. But and then working, like, you look at Norman, right? Greg Norman. Before McIlroy, I would have reckoned he was the best driver there ever was out on tour by a long streak. He hit it the furthest, he hit it the straightest. And then we look at, McIlroy came along and to his ease hit so many fairways straight down the middle, over 300 yards. But hitting a wedge, there's no grace. how would you put it? There's not huge technique to it. It's all about feel. And I think probably a quick session or definitely if he went in and had a session with them. Remember the kicking coach that Paul Carrington used?
Dave Allred.
Yeah, and Dave, who else used him?
Johnny Wilkinson.
Quite a few.
Luke Donald.
Luke Donald used him, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, after that, and even more after that.
Francesco Molinari.
That's the person I was trying to think of there. Something like that, I think, would work better for Rory than scaling back his driver. He needs to put himself into that commanding position, the dominating position. And I think working with Dave would help dramatically.
Maybe he just isn't as good as he used to be. He's not contending at all in majors. Like, I can't recall a major that he's coughed up.
Yeah, that's the one thing when you think about the conversation of where will he end up and will he get to 7 or 8. It's not as if over the last 5-6 years there's a load of near misses, a load of Saturday nights where he's right. Maybe what the Masters, the one with Patrick Reed where, you know, off the second tee or on second green, he makes a mess of it and it sort of falls apart. But like, this isn't a consistent run of disappointments. It's just backdoor top tens are fading out.
But this is my point about Jim Herman, is if he can do it when the chips are down, then why can't Rory do it when the chips are down? So, and Rory has a better swing, better technique, better being there before, being, you know, at the height of competition. Why can't Rory do it? So it has to be and can only be mental. Us talking about his wedge play or his driving and whatever else, even if it's putting, I personally think if he gets himself, and there is suggestion there that, you know, is there problems off the course? You know, is his mind completely on it? And that would have a huge effect mentally. On your own game. So I firmly believe let's move away from his wedges, let's move away from his putting, let's move away from all that, because I don't think it's technique. I think it's actual structure of his head and structure of his thought process while he's playing golf. And unfortunately, I think he's caught between the two. We've all said you either have to be incredibly intelligent to play golf or incredibly stupid. I don't think Rory is either. And he needs to get his mind more focused on what he's trying to do.
Luckily for you, Peter, you're not going to see him anytime soon, it seems, because he is not coming to the Irish Open. No. So it looks as though there is going to be an Irish Open. If anyone missed it, the Dubai Duty Free Irish Open is going to take place at Galgorm Castle in Northern Ireland. It's going to be on the final full week in September 24th to 27th. Obviously, it was meant to take place in Mount Juliet back in May, but was postponed due to COVID-19. Not an Irish Open like we've seen in recent years, a rejuvenated Irish Open. It's no longer part of the Rolex series. The prize fund, $1.25 million. It's going to be a bit of a part of a UK swing again with the Scottish Open and the BMW PGA Championship at Wentworth. So Rory basically said, look, I don't see myself travelling anywhere outside of America for the foreseeable future, and while it's an Irish Open in name, there's not going to be any fans, there's no 7 million prize fund, it feels another golf course. The reason it's in Northern Ireland is that players currently who are traveling from America don't have to quarantine for 14 days, and I think one of the main reasons is that Galgorm Castle is that they have the facilities that they can host it all on site, so all the players can stay at the course as well. John Rahm, it seems, defending champion, he's probably not going to travel. Shane Lowry's indicated he probably will. But at that sort of prize fund, Peter, like, the European Tour have to keep the show on the road, and basically that's all they're doing here.
They are, and it's disappointing to a point, and no disrespect to Galgorm, but it's 71st in the rankings of the top golf courses in Ireland. So this is going to be a non-spectator event. So therefore, it's going to be purely televised, and showcasing our 71st golf course is not, as I would say, the best way forward for Irish golf courses. But there again, I just read in the papers there, And hopefully it's not going to be the case. I believe two staff members of Gallagher have tested positive for COVID. So the Irish Open is what, 3-4 weeks away?
We're still at least four weeks away. So
4 weeks away. So hopefully that'll be the case. But you know, I have a thing about Irish Opens, and I always think they should be played as best we can on links golf courses. And this one is going to be a short one. I know they played the Challenge Tour event, and I played in it myself. And it's a lovely place, but it's not a venue that I would put an Irish Open on.
Yeah, but I guess, Dave, it's 71st, but it's probably first in terms of what they need to somehow get this tournament, in that they need a hotel on site where all the players, all the officials can stay so they can have their little bubble. They obviously want to have it in Northern Ireland so they can somehow get some players back from America to get some sort of quality into the field, and hopefully they come and stay for this swing with Scotland and with the PGA Championship as well. It's not ideal, but it's better than nothing.
I mean, what can you do? Only shrug your shoulders. As you said, the European Tour on a very tight budget now. There are certain boxes that need to be ticked when you're staging a tournament this year that you never would have had to tick before. There probably isn't a links golf course in Northern Ireland that has the facilities required to be able to get this done safely, to set up the bubble that's required to get the players over and out of there safely after the tournament. Look, I know they did move it to Northern Ireland, so it might encourage some of the American-based players to come over, but that doesn't look like it's going to be an incentive. As we know, you've mentioned McIlroy, Rahm not coming over, Lowry, Oman and Hawing about coming over. Why would they come over? There's so little in it for them to make the trip. McIlroy has already written off an Irish Open in his career for other reasons. I doubt this was a decision he had to spend any time thinking over.
And they're going to have to go back, because they're going to want to play the Masters come November. So, okay, Lowry probably wants to get home at some stage. I think he's been away for probably about 7 or 8 months, and I think his family are back home, so he probably does want to get back. But for most of the players, unfortunately, they won't. Like, I have no idea whether we're going to be able to go and cover
it. For Shane, though, it's still no good, because he's, okay, it's into Northern Ireland, but if he comes back into the Republic, then he has to quarantine for two weeks to go back to America. So that's not going to work.
So, well, maybe the family can go up to him.
Well, let's hope Offaly still isn't in lockdown when the tournament starts.
Yeah, missing the Masters because they put Offaly into lockdown a day beforehand.
Yeah.
Just while actually we're talking about the Irish Open, I think we should give a mention, some incredibly sad news on the European Tour this week with the passing of Kate Wright, just 36, two-year battle with cancer. Just shocking news when it came through the other day. I know a lot of our listeners probably maybe didn't know Kate, but for anyone who's covered golf or worked around the European Tour at any stage over the last decade, they would have got to know her well. And she was the European Tour's media relations officer and just the most welcoming person you could ever meet in a media center in what is a bloody tough job with long hours and a lot of people putting demands on you. And she just always approached it in such a fun way, a big smile on her face. And I know that obviously it's devastating news for her family, but also for everybody on the European Tour at Wentworth as well, who were so close to her. And yeah, I think, Dave, it was a shock to all of us, because anybody, like, it's an incredible thing, they go around the world, yet still you'd arrive at an Irish Open, Kate would be the first person you'd meet, and it's as if you'd met her every week of the year. And yeah, we definitely had some good nights out as well, I think, back in Killarney and a couple of the Irish Opens down through the year. So yeah, it's really devastating news.
Yeah, we've been lucky enough to cover a lot of them over the years, and I wasn't even aware that Kate was ill until I saw a tweet during the week. I think it was from Brian Keogh confirming that she had died. So young, it's just incredibly sad. She was a real crafty Cockney, and even though she was, I mean, those people who work in those jobs on the European Tour, because it's such a week-to-week thing, the pressures that go with it, I can't even imagine what they are, particularly in a couple of the Irish Opens over the years where the weather has been really bad and they've had to deal with far more than they might in another week. And she never really let it get on top of her. She was always able to still have a little bit of a laugh, despite the fact that she had a list as long as both of her arms of things that she had to get through and priorities she had to, which is still a time for everybody. And it's a massive loss for golf. It really is. And it's just incredibly, incredibly sad.
Yeah. And it's obviously been a tough few months for the European Tour and Peter in general, because of the cutbacks they've had to make and because of the damage the pandemic has done. And listen, for everybody in there, this is going to be hard to deal with. And it is, like, it's a traveling circus. Everybody gets on board. And if you sign up to work in the European Tour, you travel the world together, you spend pretty much all day, every day together.
correct. Yeah, it is one big family, or you know, or something like it. And very sad, you know, such a young age. And, you know, just our deepest regrets and sympathies go to our family.
Just before we finish up, I do want to touch on the ladies' golf. So the Ladies Open Championship is on this week. We might talk about it next week. I don't know why I'm admitting this, but I had a terribly, terribly embarrassing moment yesterday. So I was texting Christina Kim, the American golfer, who's been brilliant on the coverage of the PGA Tour while the ladies' golf was off for a few months, and she was very much involved in the coverage in America. And we got to know her a little bit at times during the Solheim Cup, and she played a lot of Irish Opens around that time, and brilliant personality. So I just texted her saying, any chance you come to the podcast to talk about the ladies' open? And she said, listen, tournament week, once I'm kind of in situ, I don't really want. And I was like, oh, listen, loving the coverage. Enjoy the week or something like this. She's like, oh, I may have said, I wasn't sure if you were over or if you'd be doing the coverage from America. She's like, well, actually, I'm playing.
Well done, Nathan.
Oh, so hopefully we'll talk to Christina next week. And we can get her thoughts on playing in the Ladies Open. I was watching it on Sunday afternoon, the Scottish Open, the Ladies Scottish Open. Stacey Lewis won it in the end. And so ladies golf obviously struggles for exposure at times, but when you do find it getting the exposure and it does get that primetime slot on Sky, whether it's Sunday afternoon or Sunday night, it's generally brilliant to watch. It's probably far more relatable in many ways in how they're hitting the ball than the men's game, which is just at a ridiculous level. But also there's generally a lot of drama and a lot of little bite and niggle throughout it. And that was the case again. I ended up with a four-person playoff, and some of the quality golf was, because the conditions were so difficult, some atrocious shots and some ridiculously good shots. But dear God, it went on forever. It was so bloody slow. To the extent it took the final group 5 hours and 13 minutes for the final threesome to play their final round.
Shocking.
Absolutely. Stacey Lewis had sort of spoken about this on the Saturday. She played with Atahara Muñoz and Jennifer Song for both Saturday and the final round, and said on Saturday night, look, the pace of play is dreadfully slow. It doesn't play into my favour. People I'm playing with are pretty slow. So she called them out. Seen people say, look, it's probably more difficult to hide the pace of play now as well, when there's less cameras, less people allowed in. So you're seeing a little bit more of the standing around. Christina Kim was actually tweeting saying, not playing fast enough, not gathering your information before you get to the ball, not giving a shit about the game enough to do your part, not respecting your playing partners. Pretty simple. If this is one of the biggest difficulties that ladies golf finishes. Golf in general has a problem with slow play, but in particular, ladies golf has just lost the run of itself completely.
Well, it was a ridiculous situation that Stacey Lewis found herself having to sing songs to herself to pass the time. So that she would be standing on the right side of the fairway, waiting for her playing partner to finally get herself in gear and get her shot hit. And in the meantime, she was singing songs to herself because it was the only way she could find to distract herself mentally. I mean, what can you say about it, Nathan? It's not necessarily about the players, it's about enforcement. I don't know, does the LPGA and the LET have the same slow play rules as they do on the European Tour and the PGA Tour? If they are, they're clearly not being enforced. If you're not ready to hit your shot when it's your turn, you should be punished for it. And until that starts happening, these people, male and female, will continue to take all the time they want. And the problem for us average hackers is that the people we tend to play with in our golf clubs, ahead of us, not our actual playing partners, because I don't think I could stomach that, but they watch an awful lot of this golf and they think it's okay to not be ready when it's your turn and to start reading the line of your putt or to maybe go looking for a yardage when your playing partner has hit his shot. It just feeds and drips its dirty way down through the game from the very top to the very bottom. And until these players have been called out more by their fellow pros and are being hammered by the officials, it's never, ever going to change.
You're dead right. And I think the problem is they don't have enough officials there. But, you know, there's no excuse. The last group, of course, there should be an official walking with the group and timing each person, you know. So there's no excuse for it, really.
Stacey Lewis was quite fortunate that she played with the same two both days, because having experienced it on Saturday, as Dave said, she sort of got herself mentally into a mindset of, I can't be distracted by this. So I'm just going to occupy my own mind and not get pissed off and not get annoyed, not be bitching to my caddy about it. I'm actually just going to concentrate on myself. And she just about did it. But like, particularly the last three or four holes, there was a few times where rules officials had to get involved around drops and lies and things like that. But there was no sense of ready golf at all. No. So they'd have a 4 or 5 minute stoppage for a rules official. Player would hit their shot. Then it would come to a player in the middle of the fairway. And still it's another two and a half, 3 minutes before they hit their shot. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah. And then the TV coverage.
Peter, what's your feeling on the old traditions of golf just been thrown out the window and ready golf being the mantra by which every golfer, no matter where, how high a standard they play to, should follow? For I no longer abide by whose honour it is. If I'm first to the tee box, I'm hitting first. I don't care whether someone's holed out from the fairway and just made eagle in the previous hole. If a guy is on the edge of the green and I'm 6 feet from the pin, and he has to go back to his bag to maybe clean the wedge that he's just used and maybe wants to wipe his, use his towel and then go take the putter cover off his putter. I'm hitting my putt. I'm not waiting for him because he's further from the hole than I am. All of those age-old traditions are useless now because people don't have 5 hours to play golf. Go and hit your ball. Just don't stand on the person's line or stand ahead of them when they're trying to play. But otherwise, just take your shot if you're ready and to hell with the other fellas.
Does that not? No, I don't agree with you. I don't like golf, this ready golf idea at all. I like playing when it's my turn to play and knowing when it's my turn to play. And look, I'll be ready to play when it's my turn to play. Out of my 20 years on tour, through Challenge Tour, through Main Tour, I was never fined once for slow play.
Were you often putting the clock?
I was put on the clock once or twice. Not as a group, but never as an individual. And I was always ready to play. So my own view is that would be very, if I was playing with you, Dave, that I would find that very off-putting. And that would ruin my enjoyment of the day that you were running around the golf course.
No, I'm not. No, you're picking me up a little wrong in that. I'm not sprinting around the golf course trying to get the thing done in 3 hours.
Yeah.
But I don't see why you should hit first on a par four because you made birdie on the previous green. I don't understand that. If I'm okay, ready to tee off and have my driver in my hand and you're still 20 yards from the tee box and the fairway in front of me is clear, why wait? What is the point apart from it being a traditional aspect of the game?
Yeah, well, I like that tradition, unfortunately. And there's probably no reason for it, but I like it. I just feel that, you know, if you make birdie on the hole, at least it's something that to say, oh, I got the honour on the tee on the next. So there's something for it.
Well, you've got your birdie. What more do you want?
Yeah, look.
He wants the honour that goes with the birdie, yeah, Dave.
The honour is your playing partner to tell you, great putt, well done. Like, is it not these traditions, Peter, that are holding back the game? I know this is a tiny aspect of the game that we're talking about, yeah, and golf probably has bigger problems. But since we're on the subject,
okay, well,
I wonder why you can't just dispense with these little things.
And then you tell me, right? So I hit it on the green, you've hit it on the green, you got up to the green first, you've holed out your putt. Where are you going? Are you going to walk to the next tee?
No, you see, that's just poor golf etiquette. And that is something that I actually have been accused of doing in the past. You should not be heading over to the next tee box or going to your bag and pulling your phone out. If you hole out first, even though you are closer to the hole than your playing partner, have the decency to stand back and watch them hit their putt and maybe, if necessary, make a comment on their putt afterwards. I would still believe in all that, yes.
Right. Okay, because I played a few mini tours events years ago. And I actually called, I had about a 4 foot putt and he's on the tee box. He's on the next tee box and I still have a 4 footer. And I'm going, where the hell are you? Actually, it was Asian Tour. It wasn't mini tours. It was in the Asian Tour event. And they had a habit of finishing out and running to the next tee. And they go like, what the hell are you doing?
Well, maybe they see that as the honor of, there's no way Peter's going to miss this 4 footer. We trust him. So we'll be ready.
I called them back all the way back. I made him come back to the edge of the green. I said, you stand there until I finish and then we go to the next day.
Or is there the possibility that he knew he was a little bit slow with his warm-up routine and all that and wanted get himself set so that rather than standing on the tee, probably teeing off first and is there for 5 minutes prepping, no?
No, totally wrong. But look, I agree with the pace of play, and I keep on saying it has to be speeded up. Yes, totally agree. But this ready golf, hitting it out of turn and stuff like that, I don't agree with.
What about if there's three of you playing, three or four of you playing, and you know you're all in different, two are on the fairway, one's on the right hand side, and one's way over in the rough on the left, and you're all doing a little bit of a search, and then he sort of finds it, but his bag is left back here.
Yeah, that's
fine.
You've
got to run back to the bag.
The odd time, that's fine. But it's not a case of let's run to the ball and hit it, and let's whoever gets there first hits it. There's no enjoyment in that. I know we're under time pressure.
We're not saying that though. That's not what we're saying.
Right.
I love playing the game. There's no point getting there, looking forward for 2 or 3 days to playing that round of golf, and then trying to get it played in as quick a time as possible. Yeah, there is no enjoyment in that. No. But there are examples during a round of golf where I feel playing out of turn should not be an issue. And it always warms my heart when I'm playing with, particularly with strangers. But if you're playing with the regular guys, you know exactly how they feel on the game and the way they like to play. But if you're, say, in a competition or there's a couple of guys that maybe hopped into the timesheet alongside you, I love when they say, let's go ready golf, lads. And I'm like, here we go. A man after my own heart. There'll be no hanging around tee boxes because he wants to mark his heart on the previous green.
Yeah, okay.
Let us know what you think. I'm sure there'll be lots of opinions from various people. You can get in touch on Twitter. It's the easiest way, at Golf Weekly OTB. We go through some of them next week. Gary Murphy never came out with this nonsense. He was just happy to go along with Dave. He said, Dave, I totally agree with everything you say. And that's why people like him. That's why people like him.
That's because he was trying to stay here. That's because he was trying to stay here, Nathan. And now you've benched him. What's he going to be like the next time?
We got to wrap up, but there's a really good weekend of golf ahead. There is that Ladies Open Championship at Royal Troon Golf Course, and watching a bit of it this morning, conditions are really, really tough. I think Katrina Matthew and Anna Nordqvist were the only players under par at all in that tournament so far. And then there's the Northern Trust, where pretty much everybody except for Brooks Koepka is playing. So Rory's there, Tiger's there, and that'll keep us going in the first of the playoffs. It's a strange scenario where loads of the headlines are Brooks Koepka's season is over. And you're like, well, no, he's just skipping these two tournaments, which traditionally are the end of the season. But actually, he's presumably going to play the US Open and he's going to play the Masters. And while ordinarily, again, you would look forward to these tournaments as the majors are done and there's a bit of a build-up to the FedEx, it sort of feels like, yeah, they're just, again, part of the build-up to a major championship. But still, it's a quality field. There's a lot of money at stake. I'm sure they'll all be up for it. I'm sure it'll be great. So, yeah, we'll be back. We'll do all that next week. So we are going to try and do this live every week if Peter keeps the Paul Casey stories to himself as much as possible. Around 1:30, what we'll do is we'll start letting you know exactly when we're going to do it, and then you can get your comments in live. You can abuse Peter live on air, all the better, on YouTube, which are usually very generous with their comments, Peter. You'd be glad to know, for all of us.
I'm well used to it.
All good then, lads. Thanks a million for joining us. Joel will be back next week. You'll be all glad to hear as well. We'll talk to you soon.
OTB Sports Golf Weekly with Now TV. Watch Sky Sports on the Now TV Sky Sports Pass and watch BT Sport and Premier Sports on the Sports Extra Pass.